Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'm reading True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, March-April 2024 edition. The Day Tom Mix Died, by Jeb Rosebrook, with Bob Bozbell and Stuart Rosebrook. What really happened on that lonely stretch of highway? Tom Mix had the pedal to the metal on his bright yellow Cord Phaeton sports car as he barreled along the dirt road from Oracle Junction toward Florence, Arizona. He was in the midst of a cross-country driving tour, and he had big plans for recharging his flagging circus and movie career. Mix had the supercharged Cord at 80 miles an hour, and his siren blaring that Saturday afternoon when he passed two Midwestern boys driving north on the unpaved stretch of U.S. Highway 8089. The promise of the day and the future lay ahead of him across the beautiful desert. The First Superhero. According to Arizona historian Marshall Trimble, Tom Mix was America's first superhero. Mix's movies were pure frolic and delight, says Trimble. He was the man in the white hat who rode into town and battled the bad guys. The films were loaded with fistfights, slapstick stunts, and pretty ladies. And to the relief of his adolescent fans, Mix seldom rode off into the sunset with any of them. By 1917, the Pennsylvania-born Western star was contracted to Fox Studios in Hollywood. Mix eventually made over $17,000 a week, lived in a custom-built Beverly Hills mansion, drove fast, expensive cars, including a 1927 Rolls-Royce Phantom One. He and his wonder horse, Tony, were international box office stars of the silent screen. And before the introducing of talking pictures and the stock market crash of 1929, Mix's fame and fortune seemed to have no end. Humble Roots. So, how did the boy from Mix Run, Pennsylvania, become the most world-renowned Western actor? Like many American celebrities before and after the superstar cowboy hero, Mix rose to fame on a recipe of audacious courage, serendipity, luck, and talent. It was anything but easy. But Mix never liked doing anything easy, as he proved again and again in his action-filled pictures. As Gene Autry once said, could anyone have written a character more colorful than Mix? Mix's life story started on January 6, 1880. He was the third of four children of Edwin and Elizabeth Mix. His father managed the stables for a local family, and Tom took to horses at an early age. In 1898, he volunteered for the Army, hoping to see action in the Spanish-American War. Instead, he served at a series of posts in the East until 1902, when Sergeant Tom Mix, recently married to Grace Allen, drove away from his post at Fort Monroe, Virginia, and never returned. Westward Ho. The AWOL soldier went to the Indian Territory and didn't return to the East until he rode in President Theodore Roosevelt's inaugural parade in 1905. By that time, he was on wife number two, Kitty Jewel Perrin, and was honing his cowboy skills as a hand and performer with the famous Miller Brothers 101 Ranch in Guthrie, Oklahoma. According to Mix authority Jeff Arnold, one of his duties was telling Wendy's to gullible tourists, and tall tales became part of his repertoire. Mix's own storytelling and that of over-eager publicists created for the fearless Mix an imaginary and overly heroic military and law enforcement history that has been well repeated during the eight decades since his passing. Divorced from Perrin in 1906, the single fun-loving cowboy went west in 1909 to test his roping, riding, and rodeo skills in the Prescott, Arizona Frontier Days Rodeo. His cowboy skills soon caught the attention of a young Hollywood producer, William Selig, who would make Tom Mix a star. Also in 1909, a red letter year for the cowboy, Mix fell in love and married his third wife, Olive Stokes. Fearless and Bold. Mix's first picture for Selig Polyscope was The Cowboy Millionaire. From 1909 to 1917, the boy from Mick's Run, starred in over 236 selling pictures, many made on location in Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Arizona. In 1913, Mick starred in his first Prescott, Arizona, Western for Selig. He was the villain, Apache Frank, and the sheriff of Yavapai County. He and Olive were also the grand marshals of the annual Frontier Days Parade, and he won the first steer riding event ever held at the rodeo. Soon he was ready for the spotlight, and the production company sent him to California to get more experience. In 1915, the actor returned to his beloved Prescott, where he made another 30-plus westerns for Selig Polyscope. His home was the Bar Circle A Ranch, today's Yavapai Hills. After Prescott, Mix went on to star for Fox Film Corporation, but he never forgot his hometown and its famed 4th of July Frontier Days, returning in 1920 to film the rodeo for scenes in his film, The Texan. Did Tom Mix actually make the jump? This photograph is very controversial. Some say it has been faked, while others say the stunt was actually done and captured on film. The film has been lost, but one author claims he has seen 7 frames of the contentious jump. One faction asserts that a stunt double did the jump. Others say Tom would never have stood by while someone else did it for him. I agree with that. Still, to my eye, it seems a little too good to be true. Horse and rider seem a tad small for the scale. But more than a few historians believe the two, Tom and Tony, actually made the jump. Whether it was faked or not, one thing is certain. Tom Mix was famous for actually doing hairy stunts that were every bit as ridiculous. And it was that very personality trait and attitude that later got him killed. Bob Bozbell. Quote, "The Old West is not a certain place in a certain time. It's a state of mind. It's whatever you want it to be." Tom Mix. You'll never see Tom Mix again. On Columbus Day, October 12, 1940, the sun came up over Tucson, Arizona, where Tom Mix was a guest of the Santa Rita Hotel, a favorite of his. According to the Arizona Star, the film star was in town for one of his periodic visits to the old Pueblo. The weather was cool in the early morning hours, fair and sunny. The desert would warm to Chamber of Commerce 80 degrees. Mix must have welcomed the warmth and the promise of a beautiful drive north in his convertible sports car. He was rebuilding his career in film and circuses, and the cool, dry desert morning held the promise of a good day ahead. He needed it. Swinging on a Star. 20 years before Tom Mix loaded up his supercharged Cord for its faithful drive north from Tucson to Florence, the Western hero was one of the highest-paid movie stars in the world. In the mid-1920s, he built his opulent Beverly Hills mansion for his fourth wife, Victoria Ford, and their daughter, Tomancia. Mix was under contract to Fox Studios, and in 1924, he made The Heartbuster, his 50th feature for William Fox, which the Oakland Post-Inquirer reported establishes a production mark which stands unequaled in the history of the photo play. Making his record the more remarkable, Mix has never made a failure. During the Roaring Twenties, the actor was always working, starring in more than 160 films. He even built a 12-acre set at Fox's Edendale lot in Los Angeles. He dubbed it Mixville. In 1928, after a dozen years under contract to William Fox, Mix left the studio that made him a millionaire many times over. Critics were bored with his pictures, and Mix sought greener pastures. He was desperate for good reviews and signed for half his usual salary with Joseph Kennedy's FBO Pictures. Kennedy and Mix were not a good match. He made 5 low-budget films, the last of which he completed in January 1929, the same month as he was a pallbearer at Wyatt Earp's funeral. He would not make another movie for 3 years. Under the Big Tent. Tom Mix was unequivocally the Western king of silent films, but when talkies took over in the late 1920s, Mix was not ready to adapt to the new medium. He was a showman. He loved the adulation, the roar of the crowd, and the movie-making style he had enjoyed for two decades. And he loved the exhilaration, the adrenaline of the stunts. He was a born thrill-seeker who was unafraid of putting himself in harm's way for the good of the picture. But Mix was famous for drawing the line in the sand when it came to his heroic on-screen image. He would not lose a fight. He did once and never did it again. He would not ride out into the sunset with the girl, and he would not play guitar and sing, ever. From 1929 to 1932, Tom Mix toured with the Sells Floto Circus. Life on the road under the big top should have been the best of times for the Western star, but in 1929, his fourth wife, Victoria, couldn't stop spending money. The IRS accused him of tax evasion, and in October, the stock market crashed. Mix was nearly bankrupt. Only his reported $15,000 a week salary from the circus kept him afloat. But that wouldn't last. Straight shooting. In 1932, Tom Mix again heeded the siren call of the silver screen and marriage. He had divorced Victoria in 1930, then met and married his fifth and final wife, Mabel Hubbell Ward. Universal Pictures' Carl Lammel offered him a deal that would make him their top Western star in talking pictures. While back in the saddle, making horse operas for Universal in the San Fernando Valley, Ralston Purina made a deal with the Western hero to lend his name to a new radio series, Tom Mix Ralston Straight Shooters. The show debuted on NBC Radio on September 25, 1933. The shows were 15 minutes long and aired three times a week. The show was broadcast worldwide, and his young fans joined the Straight Shooter Club by the millions. Ralston even created a Sunday morning comic strip that sold Ralston shredded wheat checks and Tom Mix comic books. Mix's experiment with talking pictures ended in 1935. His body was tired, and old injuries from nearly 30 years of doing his own stunts had caught up with him. Mix left Universal after a year, bone-weary, tired, and sick. He turned back to the circus. Mix was soon touring under the banner Tom Mix Wild West and Sam Dill Circus combined. The entertainer was now in control of his own destiny. In February 1935, Dill died, and Mix bought out his heirs. In need of fast cash, Mix made a deal with mascots Nat Levine for a 15-part serial. He would be paid $40,000 for 4 weeks' work. The Miracle Rider would be his only serial and final work on celluloid. King of the Cowboys. From 1935 to 1940, Mix focused all his time and finances on his Tom Mix Circus and Wild West. The Ralston Straight Shooters radio program was popular across the U.S. and Canada and could be heard on shortwave radio broadcasts overseas. In the late 1930s, Mix fought alcoholism, smaller crowds, and financial hardships. He faced lawsuits from his fourth wife, Victoria, and money was a constant problem. After a dismal summer circus season of 1938, Mix went with his horse, Tony, and two other performers to England in September for a 20-week tour. Later, he signed with the famous Danish group Circus Ballet, which he toured with in Europe in the summer of 1939. And then the war broke out September 1st, 1939. The mystery of the warning signs. Why did Tom Mix not see the barrier and road signs? Washed up and washed out. Western pulp writer Walt Colburn wrote up to the death of Tom Mix for our sister publication Frontier Times, and he described the death scene in this way. Tom Mix owned a flashy-looking Cord that he drove with the top down. The rear seat held his luggage, including a locker trunk. A highway crew was working on the Florence Highway, and they had put up a barrier with a detour sign. Tom Mix, traveling 80 miles an hour, had smashed through the barrier, turning the Cord over in a dry wash. The heavy trunk had been dislodged with the sudden impact, striking Tom on the back of the head and breaking his neck. He was killed instantly. Of course, Colburn was not there, and got his information from a friend who also was not there. Although basically accurate, two things jump out at me. The first is, why would Tom Mix blindly drive through a barrier with a detour sign without slowing down? And two, we now know the heavy trunk was actually a medium-sized aluminum suitcase made by Halliburton, and it is in the Tom Mix Museum in Dewey, Oklahoma. Impaired or drunk? We know that Tom Mix visited with Walt Colburn and Pima County Sheriff Ed Eccles at Colburn's Catalina Foothills Ranchito on the outskirts of Tucson on the day before the accident. In the Frontier Times article, Colburn describes the king of the cowboys sipping whiskey and trading stories with his two old friends. That night, Mix reportedly gambled and drank until 3 a.m. with Santa Rita Hotel musicians. He left Tucson around noon the next day, October 12th, drove north on Oracle Road, and stopped at Oracle Junction, near the present-day Lupe's restaurant, and allegedly played poker and drank whiskey at a roadside establishment before driving off to his appointment with the washed-out roadway south of Florence. Invariably, when a famous person dies, local legend grows up around the event, with everyone remembering him stopping at their place of business and enhancing the encounter with tales of playing cards and drinking. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but I am saying I take some of these remembrances with a grain of salt. That said, it is probably safe to say Mix had a few nips of whiskey before he took the highway to hell. How high was he? Maybe high enough to ignore the detour signs. And let's be honest, it's hard to read distant road signs at 80 miles an hour, no matter how much you've had to drink. One of the local newspapers gave this account. He was driving so fast that he didn't notice, or failed to heed, signs warning that one of the bridges was out on the road ahead. A small highway crew was working on the bridge at the time of the accident. John Adams of Oracle claimed that after the car overturned, Adams saw a figure move from beneath the cord and start to stand up. Mix supposedly took a step and fell dead. Several minutes after the crash, Martin Yonkers of Beloit, Wisconsin, and Anthony Motts of Rockford, Illinois, drove up to the crash site from the south and helped pull the actor's body from under his racing car. They had been passed by Mix on the dirt road, and they reported Mix used his siren to pass them at a high rate of speed. Yonkers and Motts also claimed a heavy suitcase had fallen against Mix's head, burying his face in the soft sand. If there was a barrier, it must have been hard to see from a distance, and perhaps it created an optical illusion, with the rebuilt bridge abutments below the roadway making it appear as if the road was unobstructed, and therefore unable to be seen by Mix and the speeding roadster. In the end, drunk or sober, signs or no signs, the king of the cowboys was dead. He had cheated death numerous times in his long career, and it's more than a little ironic that this anonymous wash, one of thousands that crisscross Arizona's roadways, had finally claimed the road demon. The day Tom Mix died. On Sunday morning, October 13th, 1940, newspaper readers around the country learned of Tom Mix's death in the Arizona desert the day before. He lived fast and he died fast, and the world mourned. And while Mix's demise at the wheel of his Cord sports car in an unnamed Arizona wash made front page news across the United States and in London, England, Mix's crash was hardly the most important news of the day. Germany, Italy, and the USSR were still dividing up Europe, and Japan was making war on China. Even Mix had a premonition of the future after he returned from Europe near the end of the summer of 1939. Speaking to a group of reporters in Binghamton, New York, on September 24th, 1939, he told them, "This war is mean business. I don't know how Germany can be stopped." Mix was quoted while on a short stop at Lackawanna Station. "The Nazis show unbelievable power already." True West Magazine, February-March, 2024. Winchester Warrior, by Tom Augerton. PC Baird enforces the law on the Texas frontier. The Texas Rangers are arguably the most famous law enforcement agency in U.S. history, and they certainly made their mark in the Old West. It took special men to put on a Ranger badge, men of fiber, as historian J. Evetts Haley put it. The job was tough, sometimes boring, occasionally dangerous. It tested men to the utmost. Yet sadly, many of the Rangers of old have been nearly forgotten by history. One of them is Philip Cuny, P.C. Baird, who came during this time to be known as the Old Sleuth. Baird was a Lone Star native, born in Travis County on March 4, 1862. At the age of 20, he joined Company D of the Rangers Frontier Battalion, serving under Captain L.P. Syker until 1884. Even in that relatively short period of time, Baird saw some hot action. Fence cutting and cattle rustling had become a big problem in Texas, and the Rangers were sent to stop the practice. In July 1884, Baird, leading three other Rangers, discovered several fence cutters near Green Lake. When ordered to surrender, the five scofflaws began shooting at the lawmen. One of the Rangers with Baird was wounded, but he and his men returned five and killed one of the outlaws. The others were taken into custody. After taking a few years off to raise and support a family, Baird was elected sheriff of Mason County in 1888. It was dangerous work. The next year, Baird and a deputy responded to a fight outside Garner's Saloon in the town of Mason. As they arrived, two local brothers, John and Jesse Simmons, opened up on them. The lawmen stood calmly, facing the drunken men. Baird took aim and killed John Simmons, the saloon proprietor, with a single shot. Deputy John Butler fatally wounded Jesse, who was a former Ranger himself. Baird held the sheriff job until 1896, when he was appointed as a special Texas Ranger attached to Company E of the Frontier Battalion. He retired in 1898, or tried. Baird agreed to run for Mason County Sheriff once again in 1928, when he was 66 years old. But the old lawman had run out of trail. He died of pneumonia in San Antonio's Baylor Hospital on March 9, 1928. Baird wasn't totally forgotten. On June 2, 2012, the former Texas Rangers Association honored him at his grave in Mason with a benediction of the Rangers Prayer, the placement of a Texas flag, and the playing of taps. They marked his last resting place with their Texas Rangers Memorial Cross, a mounted circle badge. An unsung hero finally got his due. Tom Augerton is a Cave Creek, Arizona-based freelance writer. True West Magazine, February-March 2024. Seaber Goes Down by Bob Bozbell. The Apache Kid versus Al Seaber, then everyone in Arizona. June 1st, 1887. Absent from duty for 5 days, the Apache Kid, along with four other Apache scouts under his command, ride single file into the headquarters of the San Carlos Reservation near Globe, Arizona. The Kid has been serving as the acting chief of scouts while Al Seaber was away at Fort Apache and the White River sub-agency. Now that Seaber is back in San Carlos, he has summoned the Kid after hearing he killed another Apache in an alcohol-fueled family feud. The offending liquor? Tizwin, a traditional Apache drink made from the heart of the mezcal plant. Told by a messenger that the Kid wants to powwow, Seaber contacts the commanding officer, Captain Francis Pierce. Two interpreters are also notified. The clock is approaching 5 p.m. as Seaber and Pierce proceed, on foot, from headquarters to Seaber's tent, a 75-yard walk, to meet their incoming party. Despite the appearance of the Kid and his men, who are carrying their arms openly in direct violation of camp regulations, none of the men in Seaber's party is armed. As word of the scout's arrival is spread, other Apaches from the nearby camps are gravitating toward the tent, and some of them are armed as well. Walking up to the scouts, Seaver says, "Hello, kid." Returning the greeting, the Apache kid and his scouts dismount with their weapons in their hands. Captain Pierce asks, "Where are the five scouts who have been absent?" The Apache kid and the others step forward. "Give me your rifle," Pierce orders the kid. The kid complies. Pierce demands his gun belt too, and the kid gives it up. The captain places the rifle against Seaver's tent and the gun belt in a chair. He then demands the same from the other four scouts. They in turn give up their arms and gun belts. Pointing in the direction of the guardhouse, the captain barks, "Calaboose!" Spanglish for jail. Several of the Indians pick up their gun belts and remove their knife scabbards. At this point, both Pierce and Seaver hear an unusual commotion. They turn to see mounted Indians loading their rifles. The assembled Apaches later claim one of the interpreters, Antonio Diaz, had intimated, with Apache sign, that the arrested scouts would be sent to the island, which signified Alcatraz, or even Florida, where Geronimo and other Apache leaders were being held as prisoners of war. Alarmed by this prospect, several of the disarmed scouts lunge for their weapons as Captain Pierce jumps in between them, trying to shove their guns away and out of reach. The kid makes a grab for his carbine, but Seaver grabs the rifle with his right hand while shoving the kid back with his left. Unable to retrieve his weapon, the kid runs around the tent and disappears. "Look out, Seaver!" Pierce yells. "They are going to shoot!" Seaver kicks the guns toward the tent as two shots ring out, one right after the other. Seaver and Pierce dive into the tent as bullets rip through the twin openings from front to back. Seaver grabs his weapon and runs out to engage the shooters. He fires at a mounted Apache who had just fired at him. But before Seaver can fire again, a .45-70 slug tears into his left leg below the knee, breaking the bone and knocking him flat. He crawls back into the tent as the Apaches disappear into the twilight. The unexpected gunfight is over, but the long, tragic nightmare of the Apache kid has just begun. Quote, "The Indians know by motions, we know by signs. Antonio reached out his hand and made a circle in his hand and spoke in Apache at the same time. He says that the five scouts will be sent down to the islands." Chief Ganache, an eyewitness to the fight, who testifies that Antonio Diaz's sign conveyed to the Indians that the scouts would be sent to Alcatraz or Florida, which triggered the shootout. Aftermath, odds and ends. After 24 days of running, the Apache kid surrendered. A military court convicted him and four other scouts. When the jury was deemed prejudicial, the kid's sentence was overturned and he was sent home after serving 16 months. Angry Arizona citizens demanded and got a civilian trial in which the Apache defendants were sentenced to 7 years. While the kid and the scouts were being transported to Yuma Territorial Prison in November 1889, they escaped. Military and civilian authorities launched a colossal manhunt for the escapees. By the summer of 1890, all the fugitives had been killed or captured, all except the Apache kid. By 1892, the state of Arizona offered a $6,000 reward for the kid, and several officers were commanded to bring in the kid dead or alive. No one ever claimed the reward. New research by historian Linda Sanchez has uncovered evidence of the Apache kid being slain by Mormon fighters living in Sonora, although others believe the Apache kid escaped and lived out his life in the Sierra Madres. True West Magazine, February, March, 2024 edition. The Wild, Wild West by Stuart Rosebrook. Combining Old West history with an old-fashioned Western road trip guarantees the making of memories of a lifetime. Everyone remembers their first trip to the Old West. My first memory was a family trip to the historic mining town of Jerome, Arizona, followed by a tour of Tuzegut National Monument just down Cleopatra Hill near Clarkdale and Cottonwood. I clearly remember the day. Fascinated with the ghost town of Jerome and the ancient ruins of the Pueblo people of the Verde Valley. The fun-filled family trip fueled my youthful imagination and interest in the Old West, and I have been curious about the past ever since. Today, over five decades later, I am still addicted to road tripping across the West and the United States. My enthusiasm for Western travel has not waned, and without a doubt, after you read the following adventures from our six contributing authors, you'll be ready to schedule your trip. Make your reservations, pack your bags, and hit the road to the Wild Wild West. I think you will be planning your next Western adventure before you get home. True West Magazine, February-March 2024 edition. Texas Adventure by Natalie Bright. Plan a trip to Amarillo and the Panhandle and enjoy visiting its small towns, historic sites, and natural wonders. The top 26 counties of Texas are divided by the Canadian River Valley, also known as the State Plains, Panhandle Plains, or Texas Panhandle. It is part of the larger area of level surface known as the Llano Estacado, meaning staked. The sea of grass was so dense it left no path when Coronado's expedition passed through in 1541. He created stakes, mounds of white stone, to mark the return route. The Comanches began trading with the Mexican Camacheros in the 17th century and kept the area under their control. It's a place of wind and wide open space where you will enjoy an unobstructed view of the sky. Turn off the interstate and discover where the locals go in Amarillo. Cowboys and cowgirls are real, so bring your boots if you got them. Horses are optional. In the modern day Amarillo sits in the heart of the plain. First called Oneida, Amarillo became the Potter County seat in 1887. The name means yellow, probably inspired by the abundant wildflowers that blanket the grasslands in spring. Cattle ranches, along with the Fort Worth and Denver City Railroad, established Amarillo as one of the busiest shipping points. Next came the grain milling and feed industries, followed by the discovery of a natural gas field in 1918 and oil in 1921. The influences of these vast land resources still exist, mixed with the urban bustle of a big city. Good manners are still in style, and simple pleasures rule. Beef capital of the world. First things first, this is the heart of cattle country. The area produces 30% of the nation's beef, and numerous restaurants offer it on their menu. One of our favorites is owned by a group of guys from my hometown of Dimmitt. X Steakhouse serves only prime choice beef that is aged 30 days, which is key for tenderness and flavor. Steaks are then hand-cut in-house. Located in Town Square Village on the west side of Amarillo, the local favorite also offers an extensive beer and wine list. Amarillo by day and night. The locals know that there's nothing like a pair of custom boots if you want to walk with the confident swagger of a real cowpuncher. Western Leather Craft Boot Company, Bustamante Cowboy Boots, or Beck Cowboy Boots specialize in quality footwear measured to fit your foot. Shop for Western attire at Boot Barn, West Texas Western Store in Westgate, or Cavender's. To learn more about working gear and saddle craftsmanship, plan a stop at Oliver Saddle Shop. This family-run business offers a wide variety of handmade leather products. A mile-long stretch of famed Route 66 Historic District offers more Western goods, antiques, and a variety of eateries in historic buildings. Located on 6th Avenue between Georgia and Western Streets, it was the first residential and business district in the city. There are two museums located on Interstate 40 that celebrate the American West. Amarillo is home to the American Quarter Horse Association and Museum, the world's largest equine breed registry. The Quaday Museum of the American Indian is open during the summer, Thursday through Saturday, and the dinner show includes an authentic American Indian dance performance. For a night on the town, Starlight Ranch was voted best live music venue. For something different, Shark Beach Burgers on the Claude Highway created their own sandy beachfront restaurant featuring cover bands. Spend an evening strolling along lighted Polk Street in downtown Amarillo. Choose from a variety of dining options and enjoy the live music that can be heard from the rooftop wine bars. Day trip east of Amarillo to Goodnight, Panhandle, Borger, and Alabates. Travel on U.S. 287 east from Amarillo for 40 minutes to Goodnight, Texas, and the Charles and Marianne Goodnight Ranch State Historic Site. The first cattle ranch in the Texas Panhandle was established by plainsman Charles Goodnight and Irish business partner John Adair. After selling his share of the JA, Goodnight set his ranch headquarters in Armstrong County and built a gabled Victorian-style house. The 1887 ranch home is restored on its original site. Heading back west toward Amarillo on U.S. 287, turn north at Claude and take Texas 207 to Panhandle. The Carson City Squarehouse Museum is a 21-building complex. It features a diorama that tells the story of our area. Climb into a train car, and my favorite, see a fully furnished dugout. Locally owned, Brick Street 200 is the perfect stop for lunch. Located in a renovated 1912 bank, the chicken fried steak is their most popular dish on the menu. Keep heading north on Texas 207 toward Borger, about a 25-minute drive. The treeless, short grass prairie on either side of the highway is the Dixon Creek Camp of the famed Four Sixes Ranch. You'll drive past the entrance to the headquarters where parts of Taylor Sheridan's Yellowstone was filmed. It is private property, so do not enter. In Borger, the Hutchison County Historical Museum has both inside and outside exhibits. Learn how the discovery of oil impacted the area. A diorama of the Adobe Walls Trading Post is the site of a significant conflict between bison hunters and Comanche forces. It's a fascinating story. If you have time for a side trip, Texas 152 East and drive for 60 miles to Old Mobedi, where Bat Masterson, Pat Garrett, and Temple Houston left their mark on history. From Borger, continuing west through the town of Fritch on U.S. 136, drive 11 miles to the Alabates Flint Quarries Visitor Center. The unique flint rock was quarried to make points, knives, and other tools dating back as far as the Clovis Mammoth Hunters. The Canadian River provided access to this neutral site where tribes came to collect the material they needed. The film, artifacts, and guided hike to the quarry are worth your time. Day trip south of Amarillo to Canyon and Palo Duro Canyon State Park. From Amarillo, travel south on Interstate 27 for 15 miles to Canyon and step into the past at the largest historical museum in the state. Panhandle Plains Historical Museum is located on the campus of West Texas A&M University. The downtown square in Canyon is quaint, and the options for eating and shopping are varied. You can't go wrong at any of the restaurants. A local farmer's market is held every Saturday morning during the summer. One of my favorite places is located in a magnificently refurbished bank building. Burrowing Owl Books stocks new and used westerns in the old vault. While you're in downtown Canyon, pick up tickets for the outdoor musical drama, Texas, which is performed at the Pioneer Amphitheater in Palo Duro Canyon State Park. Drive east out of Canyon on Texas 217 for 12 miles. The highway dead ends at the park entrance. The stark contrast between flat land to the beauty of the deep chasm will surprise you. The purple, gray, and dark red layers of rock forming the 800-foot canyon walls give witness to millions of years in geological time. At the first lookout, you will discover a view that will take your breath away, and the Canyon Gallery and Visitor Center with equally stunning Native American pottery and jewelry. Enjoy a leisurely drive on a well-paved road that loops through the park and open your vehicle windows for the scent of salt cedars and the chirps of cicadas. Check the website for entry fees, reservations for camping sites or cabins, and park alerts relating to heat restrictions. horseback riding. On Farm to Market Road, 1258, south of Amarillo, discover the Los Cedros Ranch and Cowgirls and Cowboys of the West for horseback riding. Located on the rim of Palo Duro Canyon, they are rated number one on TripAdvisor for Amarillo activities. You can learn about the area's history and receive instruction on saddling. Pick a horse from Palo Duro Riding Stables or choose a zip line that extends across the canyon, located about 1 mile before the entrance to Palo Duro Canyon State Park. Old West Stables is located inside the park, and Palo Duro Creek Ranch offers Jeep tours as well. Life's a rodeo. The skills required of working cowboys and cowgirls are celebrated through organized events, and Amarillo is host to several of these competitions. A cattle drive through downtown on Polk Street kicks off the Coors Cowboy Club Ranch Rodeo every June. The Will Rogers Range Riders is the oldest continually operating riding club in the U.S. and hosts their rodeo every July. The Tri-State Fair and Rodeo is held in September, and the Working Ranch Cowboy Association's WRCA World Championship is held the second weekend of November. The WRCA structures its competition around the skills needed on today's ranches, with ranch teams comprised of actual day-working cowboys and cowgirls. Rodeos are held in most every community throughout the Texas Panhandle during the summer and fall. The contests are the perfect opportunity for cowgirls and cowboys to show off their abilities. Located northwest of Amarillo, Dalhart has been hosting the annual XIT Rodeo and Reunion since 1937. Hospitality and an unforgettable sky await you in Amarillo. True West Magazine, March-April 2024 edition. Rawhide by Johnny D. Boggs. Getting along little dogies up the Western Trail is still a fun road trip today. By the 1880s, time was catching up with the Western Trail. The cattle drive, highway from Texas to Kansas, Nebraska, Dakotas, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana. Just as time and angry farmers and stock raisers had caught up with the Shawnee and Chisholm homes before. It's easy to blame Texas fever, the tick spread disease that proved fatal to domesticated cattle along the trail's path. Texas longhorns were immune for the closing of the trail. But Kansas sodbusters weren't entirely to blame. Texas cattleman J.G. Reed told a Kansas City Times reporter in 1881, "Well, sir, the fact is there's a market for cattle in Texas, and it don't pay to drive them up north. Besides, there are not as many cattle in the state as there used to be. The ranges are becoming circumscribed, and settlers are being brought in by the railroads, especially in northern Texas, and they're taking up land for farming purposes that used to be devoted to stock ranging." Reed estimated about 180,000 would hit the markets that year, though some claim that 200,000 are on the drive. Claim? Was Reed suggesting that a Texan might exaggerate? He wasn't alone. 5 years earlier, Mines, Metals, and Arts reported, "It is known by actual account that the 55,000 head of cattle reported to have passed up the Western Trail in 1876 does not exceed 35,000. Sightseeing. John Little gets credit for blazing what eventually replaced and topped the Chisholm Trail. In 1874, Little bought 3,500 longhorns from southern Texas to the Red Cloud Agency at Fort Robinson, Nebraska. The Western Trail started with feeder trails that headed from the cattlemen's gathering areas to San Antonio, Briscoe Western Art Museum, the Buckhorn Saloon and Museum, and Texas Ranger Museum, and Bandera, Frontier Times Museum, Western Trail Heritage Park. From there, it kept west of the old Chisholm Trail. Its most famous sites included near Albany, Texas, Fort Griffin State Historic Site, and Doan's Crossing on the Red River, not far from Vernon, Texas, Red River Valley Museum, where it crossed into present-day Oklahoma. From there, the trail passed near Frederick, Pioneer Town Site Museum, Clinton, Oklahoma Route 66 Museum, which was formerly the Western Trails Museum, before moving to Kansas and Dodge City, Boot Hill Museum, and beyond, Ogallala, Nebraska, Boot Hill, Miles City, Montana, Range Riders Museum, Deadwood, South Dakota, Adams House Museum, and Fort Burford State Historic Site near Williston, North Dakota. Some argue that the trails started further south, in Mexico, and went even farther north, Saskatchewan. Forgotten sites included places with names like Indian Camp, Red Clark's Longhorn Roundup on Bear Creek, and Maley's Roadhouse. What's in a name? The trail took on other names: Great Western Trail, Fort Griffin Trail, at least by 1876, Dodge City Trail. Not that names mattered. Most everyone has heard of the Chisholm Trail, the Goodnight Trail, and the Loving Trail, George W. Saunders recalled in The Trail Drivers of Texas. But a matter of fact, most of the trail drivers did not care anything about the name of the trail they were traveling, as they were generally too busy to think or care about its name. A son of Goliad County rancher, Saunders had taken part in his first cattle drive as a 17-year-old in 1871. He was president of the Old Time Trail Drivers Association when the Trail Drivers of Texas, compiled and edited by J. Marvin Hunter, was first published in 1924 under Saunders' direction. Herding cattle and lots of horses wasn't easy, and still isn't. In another Trail Drivers of Texas account, Saunders recalled a trip up the Western Trail in 1884. There were many herds on the trail that year, and we wanted to keep in the lead, so I kept my herd moving forward all the time. I would go on ahead and select herding ground for nights and grazing grounds for nooning, graze the horses up to these grounds, and grazed or drove them off, never allowing them to graze back at all, for I had learned that good time and lots of it were lost by the way old way of stopping a herd and allowing it to graze in every direction, sometimes a mile or more on the back trail. In such cases, the stock would travel over the same ground twice. Competing trail herds weren't the only concerns of the drives. In 1880, the Caldwell Commercial reported that a cattleman had to stop near the town instead of driving to Ogallala after finding neither water nor grass on that route, and would have to winter the herd nearby. End of trails. The Western Trail was longer distance-wise than the Chisholm Trail. It had a longer career, thanks to Kansas quarantine lines, and it shipped more cattle, if we can believe the figures, 6 million to 7 million, estimated by some to be as high as 8 or 9 million, to the Chisholm's roughly 5 million. But like the Chisholm and Shawnee, the Western Trail's days were numbered. Kansas cattle continued to die from Texas fever. In September 1877, the Inland Tribune of Great Bend, Kansas, reported that a Colonel Stone had bought 40 cattle in Colorado and driven them across the Dodge City Trail, losing 10 shortly afterward to Texas fever. The newspaper declared, "There is no use talking. The air of unnaturalized Texas steer is certain death to our civilized cattle." In 1885, Kansas declared Texas cattle off-limits statewide, and proposals for a national cattle trail from Texas to the northern ranches and markets never materialized. As the Denison, Texas Sunday Gazetteer remarked that May, "When the Fort Worth refrigerator works go to shipping beef again, the Western cattle trail will be replaced by the Missouri Pacific." Those trail driving days were soon over. Cattle drives would be done by railroads, which J.G. Reed had predicted years earlier. "There will always be a big supply in the state of Texas," he said back in 1881, "but from year to year, there will be fewer cattle driven north. Until that business will be abandoned altogether, Texas will become the cattle market, and even now, we are getting our price there." A wide spot in the road. All surviving Old West military forts, whether reconstructed, ruins, or still active, have rich histories, but few can match Fort Robinson in the Heartache Department, the destination of John T. Lytle's cattle drive that opened up the Western Trail when he drove a herd to the Red Cloud Agency in 1874. Fort Robinson is site of Crazy Horse's death in 1877 and the Cheyenne breakout of 1879 that left 64 Indians and 11 soldiers dead. Established in 1874, the post remained active until 1948. It became a Nebraska state park in 1956 and a National Historic Landmark 4 years later. Today, the park is home to historic buildings, cabins, 22,000-plus scenic acres to explore, and bison and longhorn herds. Lodging is available in former officers' quarters, dating from 1874 to 1909, and the 1909 enlisted men's quarters. Tent and camper sites are also available. Online, outdoornebraska.gov. True West Magazine, March, April, 2024. Firearm Conundrums by Phil Spangenberger. A few questions puzzle nimrods and veteran shooters alike. Single action? Double action? One of the many enigmas to newcomers in the Western gun world is the description of operating a single action, SA, versus a double action, DA. Why are two actions required of the shooter to fire a single action revolver, while only a single act is needed to get the same result from a double-action wheel gun? To fire an SA, the shooter must first pull back the hammer to the firing position. Secondly, the trigger must be pulled in order to release the hammer and fire the arm. As the hammer is cocked back to the firing position, the SA also rotates the cylinder into battery, lining up a cartridge under the hammer for firing. Thus, despite accomplishing two mechanical actions, with a single pull of the hammer, the shooter must still pull the trigger in order to complete the firing sequence. The term single action means the operator is only capable of accomplishing one task at a time. With a DA revolver, the simple act of pulling the trigger causes the hammer to be cocked back to the firing position while rotating the cylinder into battery, then releasing the hammer, thus firing the gun. The mechanics of the DA accomplishes two actions through one act of the operator. So you can see the terms single action or double action refer to the firearm's mechanical capabilities, or lack of, not the shooter's. Muzzle-loading six guns? Why are black powder percussion revolvers called muzzle loaders when they don't load from a muzzle like a rifle or shotgun? They're stoked through the face of the cylinder. Such misleading terminology is like calling an elk a reindeer. They are both of the deer species, but each animal is a different breed, with looks and other factors that differ from one another. Just because a cap and ball wheel gun uses separately loaded powder and ball ammunition that is rammed home via a loading rod, like a long arm, it's different because a cap lock revolver is charged via the cylinder, not the muzzle. Shouldn't we call them cylinder loaders? Just asking. Navy Colt, 36 or 38? The 36 caliber 1851 Navy Colt and other cap and ball so-called 36 bore revolvers actually measure 0.35 inches, a 38 bore size. Yet a modern 38 Specials wheel gun bore mics at 3.357 inch. A rough comparison in power between the 36 round ball and the 38 special shows that a standard 36 caliber loading of 22 grains of FFFG black powder pushing a 70 grain lead round ball produces around 710 feet per second FPS of muzzle velocity with approximately 78 pounds of muzzle energy. This actually puts the 36 round ball load closer in punch to a 32 S&W long cartridge, which generates about 705 FPS of muzzle velocity and a muzzle energy of around 108 foot-pounds. The 38 Special with its 158 grain lead round nose bullet can churn out 800 FPS and 225 foot-pounds of muzzle energy. Nonetheless, in its time, that soft lead 0.375 inch round ball did some pretty fair damage, especially when the medical technology of the mid-19th century is considered. 1858 Remington? No such thing. Many gun buffs refer to Remington's New Model Army and New Model Navy percussion revolvers, produced in 1863 to 1875 and 1878, respectively, as the 1858 Remington, when no such model name ever existed. This misnomer can be traced back to the early 1960s when Val Forget, founder of Navy Arms Company, decided to add replicas of the famed Civil War era Remington to its growing list of reproduction black powder revolvers. In order to avoid problems with Remington Arms Company, Val told me he decided to name his percussion six-gun after the patent date, found stamped along the top of the 1860s original E. Remington & Sons revolves barrels, which read, patented September 14th, 1858. Shooters, collectors, and arms dealers alike never bothered to find out what E. Remington & Sons officially dubbed their revolvers and just accepted Forget's sales title of his Remington Repros. Now, arms scholars, dealers, firearms auction houses, and others know that the new model Army or Navy model by Forget's made-up sales name, it's the rare fan gun fan who calls them by their rightful moniker. No foul, no harm. But it's interesting how a made-up 20th century handle can be accepted as official for a 160-plus-year-old firearm. Think about it. Maybe you have your own firearms conundrum.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.